You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Lisa C. returns to the show this week. Lisa C. is the author of many novels, including The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane, Shanghai Girls, and China Dolls, to name a few, and she's the author of the nonfiction classic On Gold Mountain. Her newest novel is The Island of Sea Women. Lisa C., welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
I love your novels because they're not only well-written and dramatic and satisfying fiction, but I always learn some aspect of history that I was completely unfamiliar with. Last time I learned all about tea, and now I'm learning all about Korea. And I know you do a lot of research, but I want to know how do you... All of your novels have the experiences of Asian women in the center of the story, but I'm curious, how did you come to tell us this story?
So about 10 years ago, I was sitting in a doctor's office, waiting to be called in and waiting and waiting and waiting. And you know how you just start flipping through magazines. And I came across this tiny little article, like one paragraph, one photo, about these diving women from Jeju Island off the tip of South Korea. And I tore it out of the magazine and took it home with me. And of course, I had to finish another book, and I wrote a couple of other books. But then there came this moment when I just thought, I really have to do this now. And, this island has been traditionally a matrifocal society, so not a matriarchy, but a society focused on women, where the women have been free divers. And they take deep breaths. They go down about 60 feet. That's deep enough to get the bends. They stay underwater 2 to 3 minutes. I've tamed myself. I can only last about 45 seconds. They harvest seafood, and so they're the breadwinners in their families, and their husbands are the ones who take care of the kids, do the cooking, keep the house. And it used to be that these women would retire at age 55 if they lived that long. And there were still, in the late 70s, about 30,000 of them left. Today, they're under 4,000, and when I went there, I interviewed women in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, most of whom were still diving. And they say that in about 15 years, this culture is going to be gone from the earth. And so I just, like I said, I just all of a sudden realized, I can't wait 15 years. I can't wait 10 years to come back to this. I have to do it now.
And there's so much history that you tell. How did you decide where, when to set your story? How much of your story is based on fact?
Well, that's really an interesting question, right? Because I think that's been an issue with every single book that I've written. If I think about Snowflower and the Secret Fan, which is about these women who invented a secret writing system and they used it and kept a secret about it for 1,000 years. So I could have set that 1,000 years ago. I could have set it 500 years ago. I could have set it right when it was dying out and people were being punished for using it. So that happens with every book. Like, what is the time period? And with this one, I ended up choosing a more relatively contemporary time, starting in 1938. And the reason was I wanted to be able to use the Japanese colonial period. So Korea was a Japanese colony from 1910 to 1945. And then you also have in there the Sino-Japanese War, World War II, the division of Korea into North and South, the Red Scare, and on this island, all of this leads to a particular incident, event called the 4-3 incident, which happened in 1948. And so I really wanted to use that once I knew about it, because I felt it was such an important piece of history that we had never heard about, but even the people in Korea have not known very much about, because it was kept a secret for 50 years. And if you spoke about what had happened, or if you wrote about what had happened, or if you were in your kitchen and just mentioned it and someone happened to be walking by and heard you, you could be arrested, you could be sent to jail, you could be killed, and so could your family. And so I really felt that I definitely wanted to use that period, and then lastly, coming up to a relative present of 2008, which is when on this island the big memorial park opened, and that the island today, despite everything that's happened there, is now known internationally as an island of peace. And so to look at this idea of forgiveness that they have taken on as an island that is now an inspiration to other countries around the world.
And it's a beautiful story, as well as being, you know, all the history and some of the incredibly moving history. But it seems to me the hard part would be coming up with a story. So, like, you could just write, why, I know you've written a marvelous nonfiction book, so why do you want to write fiction, and how do you come up with the story to tell?
Well, I think there are a couple of things about that. The first is that what I love about fiction is you open the pages and you step into another world, you step into another culture, you step into another time, and you may be turning the pages because you want to know, did the boy get the girl? Are the girls going to remain friends? What's the betrayal? Are they going to make up? Is there a murder? Who is this going to be solved? What's the conspiracy? All of those things that keep you turning the pages. But along the way, you can learn so much, and you can be immersed again in this other culture, another time. And so I personally love that about books. But for me, I always start with the characters and the relationship and the main emotion that I want to weave through the book. And so I've been writing about women's relationships, best friends for life, sisters, mothers and their children, mothers and daughters in particular. We have to remember that we have hundreds of years in the Western canon, and most of that and most of women's relationships have been written by men. And yes, there are a few people, we can think of Jane Austen, the Bronte sisters, George Eliot, who wrote books that we all love, but really they were far and in between. And so this phenomenon of women writing about women's relationships and women's emotions is still relatively new and relatively untapped. And I have been interested in what I would call the dark shadow side of women's relationships, and particularly with friendship. That we will tell a friend something that we wouldn't tell a husband, a boyfriend, a lover, a mother, or your children. And so that's a very particular kind of intimacy. And that leaves you vulnerable, and it leaves you open to betrayal. And so that's why I see that as this kind of dark shadow side of women's friendship. And of course, this is, without giving too much away, this is what happens to the fictional Yongsook and Meja, is that they are expected to be best friends for life. They've each been kind of given a stamp of their future destinies on their foreheads. Yongsook is the daughter of the chief of the female diving collective for their village, and I think people expect her to grow up to become the next chief of the collective. And then Meja is the daughter and now orphan of someone who is a Japanese collaborator. And so she, too, has a certain kind of stamp on her forehead of what her future is going to be look like and what kind of a person she's going to grow up to be. And I think this is something that happens with everyone where you think, it's when you're 7, we're going to be best friends for life. And sometimes that remains true, and you are best friends for life, and sometimes it isn't. And so this is, their story and what happens to them as they're moving through this time period. But really it's about, their friendship and are you the kind of friend that will be brave and courageous, or are you a coward? Would you betray someone?
As you're moving through the history that you're telling, and you're weaving together your tale of the characters in your story. So what I'm wondering is, all right, so you know the history because that's there, it's real, and so you have a timeline that you're going to tell the story. And then how do you lay in bed and think, oh, I know what they could do? Or do you just start writing, and do this character surprise you? Or do you have a whole, are you the puppet master? I'm giving all the possible answers, but you tell me.
I know that I have certain signposts along the way. And some of them are related to history, and some of them are just related to relationships, right, and life. So, you know, if you're 7, you're going to grow up, and you're going to go, I mean, if you're on this island and you're a woman, you would start training to be a diver at age 15, and you're expected to get married at around 17, and you're expected to have a baby in that last 9 months. I mean, so there's certain kinds of things that I don't have a lot of control over, but are like signposts. And then for me, the real magic of writing happens when you sit down and I'm just with those characters and they guide me. They're on their own journey, and I always feel like I'm kind of along for the ride. I know where I need to get to, but I don't know how we're all going to get there. And you're right, they surprise me all the time. Sometimes I want them to do certain things, but no. No, they have their own plan. And I try to rope them in, but they're just like, no, sorry, Lisa, we're going over here.
It seems like you could have more control if you wanted.
Yes, you can, but with the last book, with The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane, there was a character who was banished in the second chapter, and I thought, I'm never going to see her again. And then, you know, about 10 years later, she popped up. And, oh, she looked terrible. You know, her life had been awful. She'd lost all her teeth. She was living in dire poverty. And I was like, oh, my God, I just can't believe. This is so sad. You know, I'm just typing, minding my own business. I could not believe she was there. And then, again, she disappeared. And then I was like, well, okay, so, you know, she made a little appearance. That was nice. And then about 10 years later, she made another appearance. I could not believe she was there. I mean, you know, you're just typing, again, minding my own business, and there she was. And I'll say what the, you know, I felt what the character, the main character in that book says, which is, there's some reason we keep bumping into each other. You're coming with us. You're coming with me now. And I felt that as the writer. It's like, here was a character who so needed to be in the book that she just kept elbowing her way in. And there came a point where it was like, okay, come on, let's go. And I had not planned for her, but I loved her. And she, you know, she knew she needed to be in that story.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm glad you joined us tonight. My guest this week is Lisa C. Her new novel is called The Island of Sea Women. She's also the author of The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane. Well, Lisa C., you were saying that The Island of Sea Women grew out of something you tore out of a magazine at the doctor's office. And so I wonder how many stories are rattling around inside you and are struggling to get out.
So I do collect things. I think about them for a very long time. With The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane, I thought about it for 20 years. This one, it was 8 years. The one I'm just starting to do research, 26 years. And I think sometimes it's just a matter of how do I find my way into the story, but also maybe there's some outside reason, like with The Island of Sea Women, where I felt like if I don't do this now, I might not get to talk to those older women. You know, they're not going to be around forever. And then others, where I have felt like maybe I'm not ready. You know, that every year that goes by, you know, we're in our own lives, we're changing, we're having different types of experiences, we understand new things, you know, we lose people, other people have babies around us, you know, that life is going on, and you're learning, and you're hopefully getting a deeper understanding of life. And so that's happened to me, and that's what's happened with the one that I'm working on. Was that I finally thought, you know, I'd always said I'm not old enough yet to write this book. And now all of a sudden it was like, well, if you're not old enough now, I don't know when that's going to happen.
Well, you're still a very young woman.
Thank you. But there is something about that I just felt that I needed to have a certain kind of understanding about life that 26 years ago I didn't yet have.
You've been writing novels for 26 years?
I think so.
And you, can you see a bunch of books in your future that you're going to write?
So actually last summer I decided I was going to take the summer off. I thought, oh, it's the first time I've taken the summer off in 10 years. Actually, later when I thought about it, it was since I was 12, because I've had summer jobs since I was 12. So this is a big thing. And one of the things I did was I pulled out every idea I've ever had. And some of them really were just like an article that I had torn out of a magazine or a newspaper. For other ones, I've already collected dissertations and books and just, you know, articles, all this stuff, maybe as much as like 8 or 10 inches high of material. And it was interesting to me, I had 29 of them. So,
yay.
Yay, I know, but that's a lot. That's a lot. So, and then, you know, there were some I was looking at, and there's a reason why I haven't written those stories. You know, maybe I'm not ready, maybe I haven't found my way in, but hopefully one of these days I will. And I don't know when or how that happens, but it does happen, and I hope I choose correctly. It's like from The Matrix, the red pill or the blue pill?
Well, most of your novels are, I guess we would say they're historical dramas, but I mean, you did write a mystery. But do you ever think, yeah, mysteries. Do you ever think, oh, I'll write a science fiction story or a horror story or time travel or something like that?
Just last night I was in a bookstore and I was waiting for my event, and I was actually seated just in the sort of sci-fi section, and I was looking at all of those, and I think, I wonder what it would be like to write a book that had that kind of jacket. I was trying to imagine that. I don't think so. I don't know. I mean, I love to read science fiction. I love to read horror. I mean, I don't know that I have that in me to write. But who knows? Maybe tomorrow I'll wake up and I'll have some great insight about it. But I love both of those genres.
Well, there is a kind of a time traveling feeling I get when I read your books, because I'm doing the time traveling, going back to the World's Fair in San Francisco or wherever you take me. But and this new book, I think it's can I say? I think it's your best book, even though I love them all. But I mean, I just loved this one. And it's very beautiful. And I love the cover. You mentioned the covers.
Oh my gosh, that jacket is so beautiful. I love the jacket.
It's absolutely
It shows two of these diving women. It is an old photograph from the 1950s. So the women are wearing the traditional diving outfit. It's like a little homemade cotton, almost like a little jumpsuit like a baby would wear, like a onesie. But they also have all the tools of their trade, the buoy, the net, and the special prying tool, which, as you know, has a pretty big significance for some of the events that happen. And when they found that photo, I was so thrilled. And then they did that overlay of the sea plants. And then the last thing is the jacket. I don't know how they did it, but it feels kind of like velvet. I just love it. It may be my favorite jacket ever. And I just want to thank you for saying that you think this is the best one. I did an event the other night in Naperville, Illinois, and a woman there, you know, in the Q&A said she thought this was the most mature of my books. And I do think that there's something to that, that again, like, I've gotten to a certain point in my life where I think I have I can't say it's a better understanding, but I do have a deeper understanding of certain things that I might not have had 10 or 20 years ago. And I think that's something that's really fun when you've read an author for a long time. You can see how they, well, do mature, you know, as writers, but also as people, and how they can bring their own life experience into the book.
Now, I know that you don't do your research by sitting at a computer and typing stuff. I mean, you probably do that, but I mean, you also go all over the place and you go and you experience. Did you actually get in the freezing cold water and try to?
I didn't. And the reason is that these women have, you know, been learning for years and years. I mean, I can swim okay, but I don't think that would have been very safe for me or for them, you know, that you need to really know what you're doing. I think if I had had now they dive with wetsuits. They don't wear scuba equipment, but they dive with wetsuits. And so, you know, those have a certain kind of buoyancy, and you need to wear the weights around your waist, and I have no experience with that. So, but I spent a lot of time right on the shore with them. As they were coming into the water, as they were going out of the water, you know, just talking to them on the beach, talking to them in their homes, and there's certainly a lot of video that I could see of the women underwater, but I mean, I can hold my breath for about 45 seconds. I don't know how deep I can go, but it's probably something like 15 feet, and again, I would not have been able to do that in a wetsuit.
I took a bath earlier. It was kind of deep. But tell me... Were they welcoming to you?
One of the things I loved about the women is they're very direct. I think part of this is because they're facing life and death every day, so they don't have a lot of patience, you know. So if they wanted to talk to me, they were like, sit down, let's talk. And if they didn't, they'd say, I'm busy, go away. Or the other thing they do is they brag a lot, you know, and they joke around a lot, and they banter. And again, I think this is because they're facing life and death every day. But I would say that maybe a fifth of the people that I would try to talk to would say, no, go away, I'm busy right now. But otherwise, they were really open. They gave me as much time as I needed. Sometimes they really surprised me and gave me just hours and hours. And, you know, these are older people, and I would say, don't you want to take a break? And they're, no. They wanted to keep talking. And said, I can come back tomorrow. No, they wanted to keep talking. So I, you know, you just have to kind of go with the flow a little bit and find the people who want to talk to you, and even the ones who don't, to just kind of linger on the edges, and maybe there's that sort of false front of, no, I don't want to talk to you, but the longer you're sitting there, then, well, okay, you know, what do you want? What do you want to know? And that's just something I think that comes with experience. You know, I started out as a journalist, so how you kind of learn over many, many years to ask questions, how not to ask questions, how just to sit and be quiet and see what people will do and say.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and my guest this week is novelist Lisa C. Her new book is called The Island of Sea Women, and she's also the author of Shanghai Girls and China Dolls and The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane, to name a few of her many books. Well, Lisa C., you mentioned that in your new book, The Island of Sea Women, there is a kind of a key historical event, a terrible massacre, I would say, that people weren't allowed to even speak of. So how did you learn of it?
Well, by now they can talk about it. So starting in about 2008 was when they could start to talk about it. But even so, it's still, you know, it's not like dinner conversation, let's just say, and it's still not widely known. That was very hard because you're asking people to relive some of the most, or maybe the most, horrible moments in their life. There was a man I met, he's a poet on the island, quite well known, in who, as a little boy, saw all the boys from age 12, all the males from age 12 up to the oldest grandfather, massacred in front of him. And he was still haunted to this day, but he talked about it. The island is very much influenced by shamanism. You know, Korea is the most Confucian of all of the countries in Asia, but this island, very different. It's shamanistic. And the shamanism has this belief about soul loss, that when you've experienced something really terrible, or if you've seen something really terrible, if you've experienced, you know, the loss of someone, as so many people on that island did over this course of this massacre, that you yourself can suffer soul loss. And spending time with that man and some of the other people there, I could really see that he was still suffering from soul loss, that he was present, but that there was a part of him that was still in that terrible time of when he was a boy and had witnessed this horrible thing. So over the course of 8 years, it's between 30 and 80,000 people were killed. 80,000 people became refugees. 40,000 people moved to Japan. 70% of all of the villages were destroyed. So this was hugely, you know, traumatic, a terrible tragedy. And unfortunately, you know, our country, while not really active in this, we were definitely complicit and provided arms and provided aerial surveillance that helped the perpetrators of the massacre.
Did those perpetrators have a sense of why they were doing this then?
They, you know, I think there, at that time, really all around the world was this Red Scare, and certainly the fear of the domino effect, and Korea had been divided into North and South. China was just about to become communist. I mean, this was something that was an issue in a lot of places, but in particular Asia. And so, and of course, you know, we see this in the news still today, these issues about North and South Korea and the different types of beliefs of how you run a government and what your belief system should be. So for many of them, they had escaped from the North, so they were virulently anti-communist. For some of them, they had relatives caught in the North who couldn't get out, so they too were virulently anti-communist. And so that really is what, you know, what was the force behind the crackdown and the massacre. And as I said earlier, you know, the island has become this place of forgiveness. It's known as an island of peace. And so, you know, for me, kind of thematically throughout the book, and I didn't really know this when I first started writing it, but I think it's there from the first scene. It's there from the very first chapter, that already there's sort of this sense of, now as I read it, you know, this sense of forgiveness that kind of permeates the whole novel. And this is something that as an island they have worked towards. And what that means is that one part of the population has to own and accept what they did, but the other part of the population has to forgive. And, you know, there's a big question about forgiveness. Is it an act of self-sacrifice, or is it actually an act of self-preservation? That through this moment of forgiveness, through this act of forgiveness, that you're actually releasing the terrible thing that you saw, the terrible thing that you witnessed, the terrible thing that you experienced, and in doing so, you're no longer a prisoner of the past. And so this is what the island has worked towards. It's not always perfect. There's still plenty of people who are really deeply traumatized, who will never forgive. But overall, that's been the goal of the island since 2008 up to today.
And so in your book, there's this theme of not just that this group of people must forgive this group of people, but also each individual has to find forgiveness.
Right, because there are things that have happened more societally, but also between friends and between families. And, you know, that is part of the tragedy of what happened there, was that it was family members against family members, friends against friends, you know, one half of the village against the other half of the village, the police against the populace, so that really no one was unaffected. There are villages that after this happened, that, you know, had been a village for, let's say, 500 years, that they divided and changed their names. And now in recent years, the villages have, you know, these villages that had been divided are now coming back together and going back to their original name. And so what was once one village, then two villages coming back together, that's also part of this whole act of forgiveness. And obviously, we live in a time now in our country where it's very, very divided, but we're not living in anything close to what these people experienced. But I still think that we can learn from their experience and learn from how they have sought to find some common ground.
So present-day politics sometimes influence your writing in some way?
Sure. Sure. I mean, yes, but that certainly wasn't the goal with this book, but I'm not unaware. It's not like I was thinking, oh, this is a good lesson for everybody about that, but I do live here. So I have ears and I have eyes, so I'm certainly aware of what's happening all around me.
And now you're on your book tour, and I have a feeling that you enjoy your book tours. I mean, I've visited you when you came to town, and it's always great to see you and hear you, and everybody loves your work so much. It must be gratifying for you.
It's really interesting. You know, as you go places and people really come out, and they have a real connection, I think, sometimes to the, you know, particular stories, sometimes to particular relationships, sometimes to the emotion. There was a woman the other night who came up and said, you know, I've been struggling so much with forgiveness in my life. She didn't tell me the story, but that, you know, I had given her a different perspective just in my talk. And I don't know. Book tours are hard. I mean, you're going to a city a day, I think of it as being kind of like a package being sent through FedEx, you know, and you know how you're tracking a package. You could look at me, you know, if you were tracking me on FedEx, oh, maybe I'm in Tennessee, now I'm in that place. And so there is an aspect of it where you're just being sent place to place to place. But I really try to feel like I'm there. And people, they want to share their stories, and they want to share their experience. There was a man the other night who was Korean, and he knew several people who had survived the massacre. And he'd already read the book, and he was so emotional talking about it when he came through the line. And you have to really respect that. Or people who come up and, you know, they'll burst into tears and say, oh, I had a friend and now we don't speak. You know, all of the things that people feel when they read a book and what we all connect to, you know, when we read books, they bring that to an event. And it's like an incredible honor and very humbling, but also a very emotional thing to feel for me as the writer.
Well, this book is called The Island of Sea Women, and it's written by my favorite novelist, the New York Times bestselling author of The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane, Lisa C. Lisa C., thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me again.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.